Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of the Good Life Podcast with Mike Sofosnik. First off, let me apologize for my voice. We all know my love for Kentucky basketball runs so deep. It's one of the most important things in my life, sadly. And we all know that Kentucky came to the Barclays Center this Saturday. They really didn't play up to my standards or anyone else's standards. And I might have done a little bit of yelling at the game, sitting eight rows from the floor, thanks to tickets from my good friend Cameron Mills. But we're not going to talk about Big Blue Nation invading New York City tonight. We'll save that for the next show. I want to talk about some books. The beginning of the year, I made a goal, not a resolution, to read 52 books in 52 weeks. I'm 50 books down. I have two to go. So when I was looking at my list, unbeknownst to me, two of my last four books were written by the same author. I've read maybe three or four of his other books, but I want to focus on two of them tonight. He's lived an extremely fascinating life. Retired detective sergeant from the LAPD, best-selling author, privileged and honored to introduce to my show right now, the great author, Joseph Lombard. Joseph, welcome to the show, my friend.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Such a fascinating life. Let's start right away with your time with the LAPD. Why police work?
Well, when I was a young kid, my dad was a cop in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a little town 10 miles outside of Pittsburgh. So, I don't know, I guess I just always liked cops. And after I got out of the, I joined the Marines when I was 17, and when I got out of the Marines, I went to college on the GI Bill, and I thought I wanted to be a teacher, and yet it didn't. The thought of it didn't turn me on. I just kept thinking about police work. And the LAPD was the best police department around here. We had moved to California, you know.
Yeah.
And so I decided to take the test. And from then on, I just discovered that it was a life for me. I think doing good police work is the most fun that you will ever have in your whole life. And I've written that in a couple of books.
What do you miss the most about being a police officer or a sergeant? What do you miss the most about the job?
I think investigation. I did my share of patrol like everybody, but I think being a detective was what I really liked. And when I'm writing books, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, I interview a lot of people. I use my experiences, used them up long ago. And so when I write fiction, a novel, I interview 50 cops. That's 50 cops for each novel that I write. And when I write nonfiction, a true story, there's no telling how many people I'll interview. Depends on the story. But when I'm doing it, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, I feel as though I'm investigating because I'm asking questions and trying to get people to reveal themselves to me, even if it's cops, you know. They're not so eager to just spill their guts, and I need them to do that. So I've learned with the male cops, I generally have to buy them four or five drinks, but with the female cops, they just have to smell the cork, and they tell me everything I want to know.
when you first started writing, I guess as a hobby, when did you legitimately think that you have a secondary career here? Was there a time?
I started writing after I was on the job about 10 years. I was going to college most of my time on the job. If I was working nights, I'd go and take day classes. If I was working days, I'd take night classes. And I just started getting the itch after about 10 years. And all I wanted to do was publish a short story. I thought if I could have one short story published somewhere, that would be a great honor. And that would sort of validate everything I'm doing in terms of college. I was majoring in literature. Why literature? It's the only thing that I really liked. I liked reading stories. So I sent short stories to every cheap magazine you could imagine, and everybody rejected me. So one day I decided, okay, I'm going to send one to a magazine that actually pays money that people read. And this was back around 1970. And so I sent the story to Playboy, and they sent it right back to me with a rejection. And I thought, oh, they didn't read it. It was too quick, or they would have realized, you know, the quality of my work. So I sent it right back to them. And I got another rejection letter, and this one said, it's no better this time than it was last time, schmuck. So I tried to, you know, I saved that dear schmuck letter for a long time. And then many years later, when I had a bestseller that Playboy wanted to excerpt one of my novels in the magazine, I looked all over for that letter, but I couldn't find it.
Now, let me ask you this. There are a few books that, when people ask me, oh, recommend a good book for this, I always recommend The Onion Field. It's fascinating on so many levels. Now, you know what? Can you give me, and everyone listening, a brief summary of that incredible book?
Well, The Onion Field is a true story, a nonfiction. And by the way, the movie's good. If your audience would like to get the DVD and see that old movie, it's very good. Ted Danson played his first role in that movie. That's his first role. And James Woods was in it, and I think his second role that he ever played. And it was quite good because I wrote it, and I put up money with others to produce the damn thing, which is not a smart thing to do, but that's what we did. And I'm pretty proud of the movie, too. The movie and the book have five important words in the beginning, and those words are, this is a true story, and you can believe it. And movies you see nowadays, they always say, this is based on a true story. This is suggested by a true story. Uh-uh. The Onion Field says, this is a true story. It's a story of two cops, LAPD cops, working out of Hollywood Station, Hollywood Division, and one busy weekend night, they were working a plainclothes detail. Like plainclothes on patrol, you know. They're not in uniform, they're wearing suit and tie. But they're really doing patrol work, looking for felonies. Like we call it in those days the felony car. And they're looking for more serious crimes to bust. And they see a couple of guys that look suspicious in a little Ford coupe. And they pull them over. And the two guys were ex-convicts named Gregory Powell and Jimmy Lee Smith. And Powell was a white guy. Smith's a mixed race guy, a black guy, but he's pretty mixed race. In fact, they described him as a Latino instead of black. And the cops pulled them over. Ian Campbell was the senior cop in that car, and he went around to the driver's side to get some ID, see what's going on. And Powell came out with a .38, boom, just like that, real fast, and got the drop on Ian, spun him around back, got him by the back of the collar, and demanded that his partner, Carl Hettinger, drop his gun, because by then Carl had drawn his gun and was holding it on Jimmy Lee Smith. And Carl had a big decision to make. what to do, you know. It's like a Mexican standoff. And Ian Campbell, who had a gun in his back, said, he's got a gun in my back, Carl. Give him yours. And so Carl gave his gun to Jimmy Lee Smith. And the two thugs, they were on their way to pull a liquor store robbery. And the two thugs put the two plainclothes cops in their little Ford, stuck Carl Hettinger in the back behind the front seat down in the well. And the other three were in the front seat. And this is in 1963, remember. You can imagine a little Ford coupe.
Of course.
And they drove the car from Hollywood up to Bakersfield, California, which was about 90 minutes away. And it was there when they smooth-talked the cops all the way, you know, like, we just have to get away. We're going to drop you off out in the sticks here. And when they dropped them off, they all got out of the car, all four. They didn't just kick the cops out and drive off as they said they would. Now, Jimmy Lee Smith was the follower. He's the weak guy. Had been a drug addict most of his life. He'd never been arrested for anything violent. Gregory Lee Powell was a pure sociopath. Well, they both were sociopaths, but Powell was definitely the A personality, volatile, a little crazy guy. And he had something else in mind. And when he had the two cops out there with their hands in the air in the middle of this onion field, which is where they pulled off the dirt road, in the middle of an onion field, under the moon, with their hands up, he said, "Have you ever heard of the Little Lindbergh Law, which is the kidnapping law, federal law, that made it a death penalty to kidnap for ransom with bodily harm?" And Ian Campbell said, "Yes." And Gregory Powell shot him in the mouth. And when he went down, both of the thugs started firing rounds into him. And Carl Hettinger ran. And then they fired at him and chased him, but he got away. Now, the story of the onion field isn't only what I just described. That's the beginning of it. The real story of the onion field is a story of stress with PTSD.
Exactly.
It's a story of PTSD, which wasn't told back in those days. You know, I wrote that book a long time ago. It was published in 1973, and there wasn't much said about PTSD until the Vietnam War made it really well known. And certainly, there wasn't much said about PTSD as it pertains to a cop. But Carl Hettinger did get away. He did survive, and the two crooks were... Powell left Smith... Sorry, Smith left Powell behind and drove the car off. Powell was left out there in the onion field, too, with a dead body. Both thugs were arrested. And the onion field is really about what happened to Carl Hettinger. Being made to feel guilty on his by the police department for surrendering his gun. People with 20/20 hindsight, Monday morning quarterbacks, second-guessed him. And he felt incredibly guilty. And it pretty much almost destroyed him. I mean, he was suicidal and everything else. And he eventually became a kleptomaniac, stealing ridiculous stuff from every store he walked into, which was really guilt crying out for punishment. He wanted to get arrested. He wanted to get fired from the police department. He wanted to be punished. So it's a classic story of PTSD, and that's what interested me. Because I was a cop then, and I saw when Hettinger got fired, I said, wait a minute, this guy's no thief. You know, he's stealing this ridiculous stuff. There's something wrong in that guy's head, you know. And so I became interested in the story way back then, way back in 63.
The book was written 10 years after the incident happened. Were you worried that the book maybe would, because Hettinger, he seemed like he was very fragile. Were you worried that maybe the book would put him over the edge, or did you consult with him about the book and stuff? Were you worried
Absolutely.
About that?
Absolutely. I spent a few of the worst days in my life after after Carl Hettinger had been sent. I'd sent him the galley proof, the printer proof copy of the book before publication for him to read. And I didn't hear from him right away. And I didn't hear from him a week and then 10 days. And I knew how fragile he was, psychologically fragile. And I sweated that out. I thought, oh, my God. I mean, if that guy kills himself now, I'll be the one with PTSD. And after almost 2 weeks, I got a phone call from him. And he said, oh, I'm sorry I didn't get back sooner. My wife and I were on vacation with the kids, and we went off camping, and, you know, this is the days where not everybody had cell phones. And when I heard, and I said to him, okay, Carl, what did you think of the book? And then I got a better review than I ever got from the New York Times. He said to me, it didn't make me feel bad.
Wow. Wow. That's pretty deep.
Yeah.
Now, you were a police officer at the time, you said. You talked about how difficult the coworkers made him feel and the job itself. Did you receive any backlash or were people upset with you that you kind of put it out there? Like other police officers.
You mean after the book came out?
Yes.
After the book came out, it was completely accepted by the rank and file of the police department. A couple of the brass, you know, some of the brass who didn't investigate when Carl Hettinger was accused of these ridiculous thefts and was given a chance to resign or be fired, and then, you know, left him adrift where he damn near killed himself. There was criticism then, and there was, you know, finger pointing. Well, I told him not to feel bad. Oh yeah, right.
Yeah, of course,
you know,
of course.
Yeah, right. After you threaten a guy with jail and you know, and let him resign from the police department in disgrace, I told him not to feel bad. A couple of them said the brass, but the rank and file went for it all the way. They saw that this was something different. This was the first real study of post-traumatic stress disorder as it applies to police officers, and they were for it 100%.
Were you working that night, or did you work during the day?
Yes. Yes. Okay. I was working the night when Carl Hettinger disappeared. Carl and Ian Campbell, when they disappeared from their felony car in Hollywood, I was working the next division south, which was Wilshire Division. I was a vice cop then, and I remembered the frantic radio broadcasts. And everybody in Hollywood, and maybe even some of the guys from my division, Wilshire, were up there searching. You know, those cops were gone, and that car was parked in the street. And it was a pretty frantic time.
Now, I was so intrigued. I forgot whatever it was that you interviewed both of the killers in jail. What stuck out with interviewing them or talking to them? Any remorse? Like, how fascinating was that, speaking to them?
Oh, it was very interesting. I interviewed Jimmy Lee Smith in Folsom Prison and Gregory Powell in San Quentin. And I've been a cop a long time. By the time I interviewed them in '72, I knew sociopaths, and so I wasn't expecting remorse. And of course, I didn't get any remorse. I mean, they might fake it a little bit, but I knew they were faking it. But what Jimmy Lee Smith gave me was very valuable. He gave me a manuscript of a couple hundred pages long, maybe 250 pages, typewritten, that he had done, telling his story of the Onion Field case. He told of how he met Gregory Powell, how they got together, how they became partners, and so on. And right up to the time that they were on death row, they were sentenced to death. But then the death penalty was overturned in California, and then they got life. But they were on death row together. He told me that, you know, he told the whole story, and I gave him credit for that in the foreword to the book, in the acknowledgement page. And it was very valuable, very valuable, because I got stuff from them that I couldn't have gotten in a short prison interview, you know. And it was really, I felt like I was put on earth to write that book, I think.
I have to tell you, I'm forgetting I'm even interviewing you. The way you're describing the book, and I just want to sit down and just shut my eyes and listen to you. You're beyond fascinating. Now, before I talk about the blooding, I have a few, like, personal author questions. Is there a story that you wish you wrote about, but for one reason or another you never did?
There were a few true stories, nonfiction stories that I couldn't get the job for one reason or another. Let's see. One of them involved a doctor. He was a Green Beret, and he wiped out his family, his wife and his two children, and blamed it on back in those days blamed it on a hippie group like the ones the Charles Manson gang.
Was that Fatal Vision?
Yes, it became okay. Fatal Vision, but I was on that before the author
Joe McGinnis.
Yeah. And I got to know Joe McGinnis when he got onto the story. Finally, the problem was that MacDonald, the doctor, didn't quite trust me. He saw too much cop in me, and he just didn't quite trust me. He wanted the story told his way, and when Joe McGinnis came to interview me, after he got the job and found out that I had interviewed MacDonald in prison quite a bit before he got onto it, you know, I remember him to this day. I remember Joe McGinnis, who's, by the way, passed away. I remember him saying to me, "Well, you actually think that he did it?" And I said, "Oh yeah, yeah, he did it.
Of course
he did it." And Joe said, "Oh my God." He said that, I mean, you know, slaughtered his family like that. He'd be, you know, he's an Ivy League trained doctor. You know, he'd be as evil as Hitler. I still remember Joe saying that. And I said, "No, Joe, I don't even judge people as evil or good. I use clinical terms. He's a sociopath. And I'm going to tell you what a sociopath is and about the absence of superego, or that thing that you call conscience." And so I sat with Joe, and I sort of gave him a little primer on sociopathy, and he went off and wrote a damn good book, and McGinnis hated him for it, because MacDonald hated McGinnis for it, because Dr. MacDonald expected McGinnis to do a little love story about how he was unjustly accused and convicted, and it didn't turn out that way.
Is it more difficult for you to write a nonfiction book or a fiction book?
I always think of fiction as being my children and nonfiction as being my stepchildren or foster children, maybe. The fiction, the novels, you know, more of it comes from inside me. And with the nonfiction, I'm more of a investigative reporter or a detective. So that's more outside me. And which is harder to write? I don't know. Yeah. I think maybe sometimes the fiction is harder to write because, you know, I know how to do detective work. And if I get the story from people, I can generally get it down on paper pretty easily. But, you know, the fiction's got to come from inside, and even though I interview a bunch of cops for the novels, still, you know, there's more of me in it, so that's a little harder.
Do you ever reread your book? I heard a few athletes who don't watch their games, actors who don't watch their movies. The book is finished, gets published. Do you ever read the book?
After it's published, I've never read one of my books
really?
After they're published. No. Something has made me sometimes go to a page to recall something, something that's said in a review, something that someone asked me in an interview, has made me go back and read passages. And every damn time I do, I see something I wish I could change. You know, I could make that better if I could do it now. And so it's I don't advise authors going back and reading their books after they're published. It's almost the same way in movies, except, you know, I've written a few movies, and except that's not all me up there. You know, that's not all mine. You know, I had a part to play. I wrote the script, but there were actors, there's director, there's a cinematographer, there's everybody else, you know, scored the movie with the music, everything. So I can watch those with no problem, repeatedly, even though I wrote the script.
Mm-hmm. How do you know when a book is finished? I hope that's not a silly question, but I'm always curious, as an author, so many of you guys are perfectionists, how do you know, like, okay, this book is finished without wanting to add more and more and more onto it?
That's a good question, because some authors just don't know when to quit. And, you know, I see it all the time in books that I'm reading. I think you're always better off leaving a little bit unsaid rather than saying too much. So I just look for a place where I feel it. I can't even explain how I know. It's just I feel that if I say any more, I'm going to be gilding the lily, you know? It's going to be too much icing on the cake. And come on, let it go. Push it away. It's not easy to do sometimes, you know? It's just a feeling I have with each book.
One of my new favorite books, I just finished it a couple days ago, was The Blooding. And because you described the onion field just perfectly, can you describe to everyone listening what The Blooding was about, a summary of the book again? Because it was you're leaving me just sitting back here, laying down now, just fascinated by hearing you talk.
Well, The Blooding is probably the first full-length book about so-called genetic fingerprinting, DNA analysis, whatever you care to call it. When I read about the scientific discovery by a geneticist in the Midlands of England, in Leicester University, I couldn't believe it, you know, that a person could be identified from all other people on the face of the earth on the basis of skin tissue, hair root, semen, even saliva, blood, of course, all of that. I mean, like a fingerprint, a DNA fingerprint. It was hard for me to believe, and I started making phone calls to the police at Leicestershire Constabulary in the Midlands of England. And I talked to a detective who was ready to retire over there. And he knew who I was. He'd read some of my books. And I said, you know, is there an author that's on this story? Because it's just too amazing. I think this was in 1988.
Yes,
he said to me, yeah, he said to me, no, he said, they don't care. They don't get it. And I said, well, I get it. If I flew over there, would you and your detectives cooperate with me and give me interviews? I'd like to write a book about this, because they used it in a serial murder case in the village of Narborough, not far from the city of Leicester, and Enderby and Littlethorpe, three little villages, were being terrorized by a serial killer who killed a couple of 15-year-old girls and almost got a third one. And he was finally tripped up because of this new science. And so I couldn't wait to get over there when I realized nobody over there wanted to write a book about it. So they treated me very well. I stayed over there a fortnight. For you non-Brits, that's 2 weeks. And David Baker, who was in charge of the investigation, just treated me like a fellow cop. And even though I'd been gone from the police department for quite a while, treated me wonderfully and gave me access to everything. And I got a very interesting book out of it, I think, and came back to California. And I brought a couple of the detectives with me. And they stayed over here for a week or so and finished up a lot of information that I still needed, you know. I interviewed a whole bunch of people over there for that book, but I needed more. So I brought those two guys back with me. And, I'm kind of proud of the book. I'm sorry that it never made it to American television. They did a version of it in England, and I saw it. And, you know, it was all right. But I wish that one of these days they'd do a version over here and let me write the script.
And it's funny. In your summary, you actually hit on three questions I want to ask you. The first was, they were convicted in 88. In 89, the book is published. And my question to you was going to be, were you nervous, or have you ever been nervous that you're doing a story and another author is going to jump the gun, rush, and put the first book out there? Does that ever worry you?
Now, this was the first time that ever happened to me, you know, where it was a current case. And it did. Yeah, it worried me a bit. But I had so much access, I thought, hell, let somebody else go ahead and write. They didn't have my access, so I'll have more of the story. By the way, everybody told me that, the cop should have known who the serial killer was from the beginning just by his name, which was Colin Pitchfork. Now, if that was fiction, I could never have used that name, but it was a true story, and that was his name, Colin Pitchfork.
And my other question, which you answered, saying you were there for 2 weeks, you got all the interviews, the family, everyone cooperated with you. It seemed like it was just, maybe that was a book you were meant to write. And was that one of the funnest, and of course the subject isn't fun, but was that one of maybe the most funnest books? You get to travel to England, and they wanted you to write the book. So was that one of the best experiences you had writing a book?
It was certainly one of the most exciting, unusual experiences, but it was hard. It was cold. I was in a drafty hotel where you had to keep putting coins in the radiator, you know, an old fashioned steam radiator. You put coins in, and the wind's whistling through the windows. I'm freezing at night. I have blankets on me and top coat. I keep remembering this is the romantic, exciting life of a best selling author, as I'm freezing to death, and then I'd have to go out and sometimes just wait around for people, and standing on corners, blowing on my hands because I'm freezing to death, and then persuading them, because the Brits are not Yanks. They're very different than we are. You know, they're very reticent and shy about such things and revealing themselves. They don't like to do that. And so I had to work very hard to get some of them to talk. But I ended up interviewing the wife of the serial killer, and of course, all the cops, the family. I interviewed the two families of the two murdered 15-year-old girls. I interviewed a lot of people, and you have to draw them out. They're English. They're not American, and it wasn't easy. It was a tough book.
And listen, you don't need me to praise you, but can I tell you what my favorite thing about the book was? Someone recommended the book to me. I was in a little bookstore here in New York, and I saw it. So I grabbed it, and I was nervous. It was going to be so much about science and the fingerprints. You had the perfect amount that you would tell the reader how the DNA thing happened, and like, you didn't get so much into science, which made the book so much more enjoyable. And I have to just say, that was like a great job. Were you ever nervous that you were going to make it too scientific?
No, because I know that I must remain a storyteller. I can't go off into a field in which I'm not that well versed. So I did enough science to make it clear, but then I just reverted to being a storyteller, you know, and told the story. God, I even interviewed the family of the first young man to be freed.
Yes,
from a murder charge. Yeah. They arrested the wrong man. The wrong man. He was the young village idiot. They arrested him and he confessed under a stressful interrogation. And they thought they had their killer. And that science set him free before it trapped the guilty guy. So I even interviewed him and his family.
I'm going to tell you what. You've been on the phone with me now for like 35 minutes. I won't keep you a few more minutes. But I have to tell you, as I'm reading the book, and we'll play spoiler alert, they arrest the guy, he confesses, and he was doing some shady stuff that makes you think, okay, he was involved. I'm looking, I'm like, there's still a lot left in the book. Where are we going with this? So I was questioning you, like, okay, we got the killer. He confessed. What goes on next? Now, Joseph, I have a question, because, and I don't know if you do this on purpose or maybe it's habit. In most of the books I've read, you seem to, and I think I've read some of you use this word, you humanize the police officer. There's a story within a story, because you don't just say, officer so-and-so. You bring up their lives and their backgrounds and the stress. Is that something that you try to do, to humanize the police officer?
Yeah. Some people call me the father of the modern police novel. And what they mean is, instead of being really interested, too much interested, in how the cop acts on the job, I've always been more interested in how the job acts on the cop. So I prefer to get inside the cop's head, which is what I did in the Onion Field with Carl Hettinger. I want to know what the job's doing to the cop. And that's so I flipped the police procedural on its head and did something different. So I've that sort of summarizes, I think, the way I write police novels. And Michael, I'm going to have to say goodbye to you now. I've got an appointment I must get to. I hope you don't mind.
No, not at all. I have one last thing. Our retired lieutenant is coming out to L.A. in a few weeks. I'm going to give him your email address, because I know he's fascinated by you and your books, and maybe you guys can meet up for coffee or something, sir.
Okay. He's retired, huh?
He's a retired lieutenant. Just retired around 3 months ago.
Going to L.A. I live in San Diego, but, you know.
All right. Well, listen, I appreciate you spending so much time with me, and thank you so much again.
Okay, Michael. It was a pleasure talking to you, and good luck with your show.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye.
Joseph, fascinating. An absolutely fascinating man. I've read two or three of his books, and I had two or three more questions. My other question was there ever a book he started and wanted to continue and just didn't have enough material, and he left it? And the other one after that, I was going to ask him what he reads. I'm always curious what athletes, what other things they're into. He's only known as an author. So, everyone, thank you for listening. I guess in the next couple of days, we'll have a bunch of Kentucky players on, and then we can tell stories about how Big Blue Nation invaded New York City. Everyone have a great night. Thank you for listening.